Hey folks, it's shape-shifting ontological undercover agent Layman Pascal here on the Integral Stages author series to talk about the book Birthing the Symbiotic Age, an ancient blueprint for a new creation. But wait, there's more. It's not just a book. There's a Substack, there's a symbiotic culture lab, there's a history of real-world experiments, there's a whole metaphorical forest floor of interwoven natural science, spirituality, and sociology here that comes together in something like a coherent culture change strategy. And that's something, right? So here to help us get beyond Game A's divide and conquer dynamics and help us build the road that builds us is Richard Flyer. Hi, Richard. Good to see you.
Hey there. Good morning. Good afternoon. Good evening.
There's a ton of stuff here. You've got a lot of angles, you've got a lot of energy, you've got a lot of terminology. I'd love to dig into a lot of it. But before we do that and see what unfolds, maybe people want to get a sense of where this all comes from in you. I love the backstory stuff. What were some of the formative experiences that opened you up to the work and the values of constructive non-separateness that seem to be guiding your life?
Wow, I thought it was really an impressive intro. Thank you for that. Wow, that's amazing. I saw you do the intro for the Limbicon, the welcome. That was amazing. So really appreciate that.
Oh, good.
What you have to say. Yeah, you really have a gift. That's for sure.
That's appreciated.
Well, a little bit background. So, you know, like you mentioned, I've just released my book, Birthing the Symbiotic Age, which probably, it goes back about 50 years. I'm 64. So when I was 12 in suburban middle class Northern Virginia near Washington, D.C., I just began to have these spontaneous, let's just call them awakening experiences. And I didn't really know at the time. I didn't share with anybody, my family, my friends, my teachers. I grew up in a secular Jewish household. And just began to have these series of experiences going through my teens and early 20s. And it connected me to something at the time. I didn't have any name for it. Let's just call it ultimate reality. How's that? The big U. So, you know, subsequently, I'm calling it, to be more generic, just a transcendent experience, you know, transcending the sense of a separate self, even if I hadn't even developed one as a kid. You know, I'm a 12-year-old, and I didn't have any context for it. And thinking back right now, I didn't really share with anybody, and I held it within myself. And it, in the book, that's like section one. I call it formation. So how I was personally formed through these experiences, but also how I began to see that I was part of a culture. I just call it a culture of separation. So there was this dissonance. There was this contradiction between this interconnected experience of unity, of just seeing deeply, experiencing deeply above and below what is surface reality. So there's like this seeming contradiction between this sense of just love and just experience of completely feeling interconnected, and then emerging into the world. And I just started looking around human society, and I saw fragmentation and separation and conflict and suffering and pain. And it was this contradiction, if you will, for a kid, that just drove me into the question, just drove me right into the question. Like, you know, what the fuck's going on? Like, what's going on? Like, as a kid, I just cussed, didn't I? Oh, well, anyway, that's what it was more like. It was a WTF moment, trying to like understand more deeply. And that led me to 50 years of exploration personally, but mostly externally as well, how to integrate that into real world, grounded, anchored community and reality, like where we're at. So
yeah, that grounding process is one of the most fascinating things for me, because it's one thing to have these kinds of experiences, which are relatively rare. A lot of people don't have experiences like these, but even the ones who do, there's this additional problem of how do you assimilate them? How do you turn them into a life? How do you lead the world to be changed? These kinds of things. That's really fascinating dynamics to me. But I noticed you're dividing your life into kind of three phases so far. And so that coming forward with this stuff and this book is part of the activation phase. I'm curious what signs you've seen, what feelings you've had in your life or in the world that have indicated to you that this is the time for that phase.
Wow, that's a great question. I think it was in 1990. I had an experience, and I just shared it. So I'm sharing the book as an ongoing weekly post, where I'm not actually sharing just a chapter. I'm subdividing chapters into hopefully bite-sized posts. And one experience that I just shared recently was in 1990, where it was an experience of and a conversation with a being, and it was about that we're in the, and I guess you could call it a metaphoric end times. So I began to see that and have an experience that we're in a period of time where it's not necessarily the end of the physical world, although that's happening and it will continue to happen. But it is the end of an era. So I began to sense that. And that was before I began some experiments in San Diego. And I certainly wasn't aware of I'm not an intellectual, I'm not a historian, I'm not a theologian, I'm not a philosopher. I was just acting on what I felt is right and following this inner guidance. But you're right, in as I'm writing the book in the last 3 years, actually, I started 17 years ago. I wrote the first chapter. But in the last 3 years, pretty much every day. And I've noticed that there's everything after, probably if I had published this book before COVID, before 2020, there would have been much, much less interest in ideas like building a parallel society. Like, why do we need a parallel society? What do you mean? Everything's fine. So, but then after COVID, it was really interesting. During COVID, this isolation, this many people could say government overreach, control, the kind of destruction of Main Street small businesses, privileging large companies like Amazon and Walmart and others that could survive and thrive, but it just killed a lot of the mainstream, local business community, charities, nonprofits. People were hurt by it. And as we were kind of emerging from this horrific reality that was global, I thought to myself, wow, okay, what does this mean? And then all of a sudden we're like the world's at war. Then there is this, the Ukrainian war, and then there's what's happening in Israel. So it's this ongoing series of trauma. And it was through this process, probably as I've been writing the book, for 3 to 4 years, that I'm realizing that there are these, let's just call them countercultural elements that are very distinct. One could be like regenerative community, culture, and economy. So these phrases, these terms, they're an evolution, from the previous iteration, like sustainability. So there's definitely an arc and a deepening of wanting to, go beyond the idea of sustaining to regeneration, which generally speaking has been external. But then there's this movement internally about what is internal regeneration to support external community regeneration. So I saw these movements, And I've consciously been interacting with leaders from not only this community, this regen tribes, if you will, but a lot of the other movements, for example, civic engagement movement. It's the so-called bridging movement. There are 600 organizations focusing on overcoming polarization. And you can find that. There's some websites that aggregate. It's called the Bridge Alliance. So they're literally, that's their frame, all the way to, so that's like in the civic engagement realm, all the way to the religious, primarily like Christians who are focusing on deconstruction, back to the land movements. So, but they're all coming, these movements come from different frames, different realities, but it points to the same source of angst, this kind of global takeover of corporatism allied with the planetary, you know, the world governments and the planetary organizations like the UN and others that seem to have a desire to continue to centralize financial and political power. So it's creating this natural reaction. So in a sense, this is what I've been seeing as I've been, you know, finishing the book and interacting with folks. That, yeah, it's striking me as we're in a time where there's multiple threads of what could be a really beautiful tapestry woven together. So I just see my role not as creating just another project or another idea, but I see that there seems to be a need and a role in community, especially at the grassroots, for weaving community. A new function where that's a role, that's an evolving role to build meta network constructs. But the unique aspect of these meta network constructs, like building a local food system network, for example, is that you don't have to give up your brand or your identity to participate as a leader in a movement like that. So we're at a time where it's really possible to integrate the personal and the collective in harmony, where there's not this like enforced political pressure to comply, like you must join this movement or this movement. And yeah, I'm not with that. I'm really more focused on the sovereignty of a human being and the dignity of the human being and the spiritual life inside each of us is so precious. And yet we live in a culture that is extracting the very life energy of human beings. And that's why in this dialogue, in the way I'm writing my book, it's to include the religious, you know, so that's very important. I think they're going to be key to this. They're the majority of people on the planet that have a religious affiliation. And I believe that this type of culture that we're in, it goes against and it's antithetical to their professed religious and spiritual and the wisdom traditions. And they just haven't been able to see it like that clearly yet. And I'm beginning, and that's what the way I released my book was more about public conversation to really, you know, share this series of like experiences that I've had, observations about how we've become unanchored from that transcendent power, just totally unmoored. And we've created like a simulated human cultural reality without reference to any underlying spiritual anchoring. Well, that was a lot, Layman. Thank you for letting me go free form.
Yeah, that's great, man. I like the way you initially situate that. I mean, the everybody's been, not everybody, but a lot of people have been aware of the world drifting in a certain direction that doesn't seem optimal for quite a while. But in that transition out of COVID into Ukraine, into Israel, there was a kind of seamlessness to the narrative, which I think helped a lot of people understand that these things are not blips. It's not like if you get rid of a president you don't like, or we solve a pandemic, or we end a war, it's going to go back to normal. It's not going back to normal. This is the situation unless we do something about it. And that requires something to go on culturally in terms of how we relate to each other. It requires something to go on inside individuals, and it requires something to go on in the systems or principles we use to organize ourselves. And it absolutely has to work with whatever anybody's identity or brand is at the moment, right? That you shouldn't have to convert. You don't have to change your worldview and value system to get on board with this. You have to go, it has to be set up so it's open and it's inviting and it's fun, and you can go more deeply into it through whatever language and structure you want to do that through, whether it's Christianity or Islam or secularism or some new religion you come up with. They've all aboard, because we need basically as many people in this tent as possible.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, you, I've noticed, seem to feel that symbiotic is a very cool and useful word. What do you hope symbiotic means?
Well, it's imagine living in a world where, from the level of an individual person to family, to neighborhood, to community, to the region, to your nation, to the planet. Imagine a world where mutually beneficial relationships become normal. Like, that's the world we live in. Yeah, that's the world that, to some extent, I've been doing my best to live in, like live inside of it myself without knowing what I was doing, you know, for the last 50 years. I mean, how would a kid know anything about intellectual constructs, you know, about symbiosis? But part of it, the word symbiotic culture is just probably one of hundreds of articulations about, you know, phraseology that you could use to describe a positive culture that, you know, is something that we could strive for. You know, a vision that could be shared. For me, maybe part of it comes from biology. You know, I have a master's in marine biology. I studied dolphins and mostly like pilot whales and their communication. So I did that while working on my master's while I was in San Diego State University. And I guess as part of that scientific tradition, we study evolutionary biology. So been informed by concepts like symbiogenesis, which describes, I guess, it's probably, there's a lot of evidence for it. Lynn Margulis talked about symbiogenesis as going from or evolving 3.5 billion years ago from individual bacteria or single-celled organisms that were like different species, who, because of changing environment back then, in a sense, aggregated into some type of physical collective field. And over a period of time, this is the theory of symbiogenesis, is that it evolved into the basis for multicellular life, basically eukaryotic type cells, basically us and a myriad of other multicellular life. But that change is, and evolution is symbiogenesis. So I was always attracted to that idea. And the way I relate symbiotic culture to symbiogenesis is, it seems to me that similarly to organisms collaborating because of the necessity of survival to cooperate, come together. I've seen that in my community work over a period of time, all the instances where I built community networks seem to arise out of a multiple crises, whether they're local or national or global at the time. That idea of different single, I call them single siloed organisms or organizations, you know, like an individual nonprofit or a business, that idea of solving problems in silos has always been on my mind and heart. And I've seen it as the major problem to address, or a challenge to address. So the idea of cultural symbiogenesis imagines a new state of consciousness where we can enter into other associations, mostly locally, and work together. And as a result, build a new, it's a new stage of development, these meta networks where individual leaders and organizations that already are doing, you know, their good works come together. And the idea of bridging silos and building ongoing network centric meta constructs to get shit done, like in the real world, that's what I've been focusing on. Kind of like a, I don't know, I must be on the spectrum, and I mean that in a good sense, in that I've just been focused on this singularly, literally for 50 years. Like, I don't have any clue why a kid would focus on something like, I call it solving the silo problem, you know? So cultural symbiogenesis is a term that I've kind of weaved in there to describe a next step, I believe, in spiritual and cultural evolution, where it just becomes normal for people to develop network-centric structures without feeling that they're being, you know, subsumed by a freaking Borg collective or some left-wing or right-wing construct that's, you know, imposed on them. So this is about a self-organizing, emergent, natural development within human evolution, where not only do we focus on our own inner life and spiritual development, but it's in the context of ever-expanding circles of trust and collectives, that it's embodied, that it's literally this transcendent energies are embodied in us through the virtues of patience and kindness and generosity and sharing and collaboration. All these positive virtues then get embedded in these new meta network constructs. So it's like this transcendent energy flows into these networks. And that's, in hindsight, what I've been doing for probably 30 years, but I didn't know it at the time. I didn't have any language. It's only writing the book that I actually been thinking about it, and I have to communicate to others about that experience. But I've been pretty much, to some extent, been in the wilderness. Yeah. And it's like being with you here. It's cool because, you know, it's kind of like coming out, you know, in a sense. I've started to do some podcasts, and I appreciate the invitation to be here and express something so important to me and precious to me. And I think it could be of value to, you know, your viewers. And I'm just here to support people who want to connect all those threads in symbiosis or in intentional mutual benefit. Yeah.
There's a, you know, like the story of science is an interesting one. It goes back anciently, but we had this idea, it seems like, in the 100 years ago, that science was a kind of mechanistic, reductionistic enterprise that was the enemy of deeper and broader lived experience, meaning-making, and spirituality. But the science of the last 50 years has really kind of unraveled that distinction. And now we have a science of fractals and complexity and living systems and symbiosis and multidimensionality and all this stuff. And it seems like one of the things that distinguishes complex systems from mechanical and complicated systems is you can't just control them. You have to figure out new heuristic principles for sort of encouraging them and steering them and getting them to self-organize and move under their own power. And I think that's where it comes around to what you call symbiotic cultural DNA. Like, what are the sort of key principles and values that we can use to encourage the formation and capacity and robustness of these new systems? And I'd be curious to hear which, you know, what do you think are like the main virtues and the main principles that stand out to you as being essential for new symbiotic culture?
Wow. That's a multi-level, deep question, Layman. What was coming presently as you were sharing, what I was reflecting on about how you were talking about the emergence of these kind of, you know, within science of, you know, complexity theories and theories of self-organization and emergence. First of all, I was thinking about how even before that, many of the quantum physicists who were dealing with the really tiny aspects of reality, you know, like inside or, you know, within the atom, if you will, many of them had what could be called themselves kind of a scientific mystical experience especially Einstein. I think Albert Einstein really communicated this well about the scientific enterprise being related to being involved also in the mystery. So I want to relate a principle, because I want to eventually answer your question. Hopefully not talking too much about it. But yeah, what the quantum physicists realized, and it's, you could get it probably from Heisenberg's uncertainty principle regarding how the observer, the scientist, is actually a participant in the experiment, and how the consciousness or the awareness of the experiment and of the observer, how that affects the outcome. And without getting too much into the weeds about what they discovered, what I'm sensing as we're talking about what are some of the principles, and I think one of the key principles would be the capacity of a person who's interested in the work of building a community would be holding space, and the capacity to see their involvement not as an imposition or kind of like just a new form of like some, yeah, I've got the answer and I'm here from the government, or I'm here from the regen crowd, or I'm here from the Christian group, or I'm here from the atheist group, whatever, the myriad of identities that we can have. It's not an imposition on a supposed community that needs us and needs our brilliance, right? I put that in quotes. So the important aspect is holding space, which implies a participatory and relational reality or philosophy or an experience to be able to participate while we're engaged in social change, in personal change, in cultural change, in different scales. I think that's what comes up for me. That is not easy, to be able to go from a culture of separation where we're used to kind of win-lose, you know, dynamics, which would be like parasitism or extraction, to go to a win-win dynamic in interaction. And it requires a really radical shift in the way that we relate to others, because we inherit this culture of separation, I call it. It's 3,000 years old or older, in my understanding. So we're talking about something that is endemic to the human experience over the last, you know, thousands of years. So being able to step into an understanding of reality as participatory and relational is not just an intellectual construct. It really is something to be lived. So that's, I think, a foundational pattern. And anyway, I'll leave it at that for now.
Yeah, it's always interesting for me to think about how much is retrieval and how much is novel emergence in all this stuff. Because when I think of something like a participatory relational disposition, part of me wants to believe that that's the ancient normal human way and the ancient normal way of all natural systems. But then there's this other voice that says, well, maybe it was never really like that, and maybe we're just figuring it out now as part of the leading edge of the unfolding cosmos. And your book is subtitled, well, it refers to an ancient blueprint. And I'm curious how much you think these basic principles were already worked out by our ancestors, and how much you think it might be something new, but it's even then better that we think of it as something old and reliable coming back, because that's a good way to handle new things.
Yeah, that's a great question. In some of the recent posts that I've released, I talk about, in many modern movements across the board, about how many of them might be considered ahistorical. Like, they're not referring to history as if something that we're discovering now is new and it's a new shiny object and it's exciting. Like, for example, integrating quantum theory or even the new biology into the developing, I'd call them the descendants of the New Age movement, that have started to incorporate some of those frames into the, you know, descendant movement of that kind of understanding about you know, that's coming up within quantum physics and science. And then it's taken and it's merged and linked to new ideas like Gaia theory, which I have some resonance with. But it's still, to me, appeals to, and it's fine, it appeals to a particular modern and even postmodernist sensibilities, but it doesn't, to me, address deeper truths that are ancient. So one idea that would relate to this ancient blueprint or pattern, I know many of your viewers obviously would know about the time 3,000 years ago, the emergence of the actual idea of transcendence or the transcendent in the first axial age. And it's this idea that across culture and religion, whether it was literally in the Old Testament, wisdom could be the Greeks in the 5th century BC with the Logos, and then the Christian reformulation of the Logos as Jesus and the Christ, but even parallel into India with the emergence of the idea of that led to Buddhism of the Dharmakaya, in China with the Tao. So these emergent ideas reflect a recent, like 3,000 years. So it's a more recent phenomenon. So when I say ancient blueprint, yeah, I suppose, yes, it would be incorporated, that idea is incorporated into indigenous traditions. You know, if you're talking about like in Australia, like 30, 40, 50,000 years, that's definitely a thread. I focus on more recent history. So when I talk about the ancient blueprint, I focus on an articulation that to me brings clarity. And I'm trying to relate it as a Westerner growing up in the West. So I had focused on the Sermon on the Mount specifically, and in the articulation reportedly that Jesus spoke about the connection between the transcendent God and the immanent reality of our world, the physical world and society and all of life. And it's that connection between the transcendent and the immanent, or as I understand it, how to actually connect to the transcendent power. That's not a metaphor. I'm not speaking just poetically, that there's a reality, an underlying transcendent power, and its energies, I would say, impregnate all of matter from the beginning. So you have this kind of top-down version of a transcendent, but a bottom-up emergence that literally we're at that intersection. And I'm not a theologian or philosopher, but I'm doing my best to communicate using some common words. So an ancient blueprint then is this underlying pattern, an architecture of reality that is, that there's an objective reality to it. Now, I know many of the viewers would question that, you know, obviously from a postmodern perspective, you know, there is no such thing as a reality, even that science, you know, let alone a reality that's pointed to by religious folks, the transcendent. So, you know, that rabbit hole, I didn't go down that rabbit hole of, you know, denying any kind of objective reality. So I'm bringing this back to what I think is a commonly understood experience, what C.S. Lewis actually called a joyful cosmology. So in other words, there was a time within the last 1,000 years where people, in a sense, had a sense that they were part of a cosmos, and albeit part of a God construct that was part of a particular development of history. But nonetheless, they had that connection to it. And obviously, there's so many, you know, negative things about those times, but I'm focusing on this ancient blueprint, this pattern that indicates that there's a transcendent reality and we can trust in it. That's what I experienced when I was a child at 12 into 13 and 14, I started having these experiences and I had no religious construct. Just imagine that. I had no religious construct telling me about beliefs. So I was like, literally, like in the wilds, if you will, doing my best to understand what was happening to me. But one of the things that came up, and then looking back, was those transcendent experiences led me to have absolute 100% trust in reality, that there's this pattern and that we're part of it. And that in my little human, you know, level awareness, that shit happening to me, negative experiences, positive experiences, all the myriad of pain and suffering, but that underneath there's a reality that I personally could trust. And that's what led me to faith. So it's different. It's beyond belief or non-belief. So that is sense that I could trust and have confidence in some underlying order and pattern within this ancient blueprint is something that I would argue that many more people had that 3,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 1,000 years ago. Yeah, sure, people might have only lived to 40 years old. They might have died of a toothache. They didn't have, you know, plumbing. They didn't have like modern, you know, conveniences. But on some level, there was this part of that ancient blueprint pattern that our ancestors over the last several thousand years, they were in touch with that. And as a result of the Enlightenment 400 or 500 years ago, we went on a different path, mostly in the West. And that path was basically to construct our own reality as if this other base level anchored transcendent reality did not exist, and questioning its veracity, validity as being superstitious, a sign of the past previous ignorance. Like, how could those people believe that? Well, to some extent, our ancestors had a lot more wisdom about the nature of reality than we do. We're like unmoored. We're like unanchored. We're like floating in a simulated human culture that is more looking like the guy, the French philosopher, talked about it as hyper-reality. We're like floating in this unmoored, unanchored reality where we have no clue that there is even such a thing. Ancient blueprint? What the fuck is that? Like, it's like a foreign idea. So what I'm in a sense reintroducing or reintegrating is, instead of me creating my own languaging, creating my own religion or philosophy or idea system, I wanted to capture as the best I could and take the best of previous worldview stages historically, and then re-embed them within the new construct of us. So that means literally as a person going up and down, if you will, the levels of awareness or complexity or being or development, but also all the stages of human evolution from the, you know, the ancients to the pre-modern and the traditionalist and then the modern and post-modern, metamodern. We've got to find some way to integrate all of those stages multidimensionally without rejection necessarily, just out of hand of these past stages as somehow we're superior. We're not. We're not superior. In fact, those of us that might think that we're in the vanguard, we might not be the vanguard. It might be some, I don't know, 52-year-old lady in some neighborhood somewhere that's like bringing her whole neighborhood together and connecting her whole community. Because what I'm sensing is needed is really a heart filled with love and an openness beyond all intellectual constructs. And to some extent, that lineage, if you will, of that ancient blueprint that I kind of identified for me from the Sermon on the Mount, I also saw that lineage manifested in Mahatma Gandhi's work as a Hindu. So he was like deconstructing the Sermon on the Mount and the message of Jesus that he got when he was reading the Sermon on the Mount. He deconstructed it and then re-embedded it within Hinduism. And then in the 1950s, You know, after he died, one of his disciples met, who now for me is and somebody that's influenced me in my own direction, is Dr. Aryaratne from Sri Lanka in the Sarvodaya movement. He took that construct and he like stripped away the Hinduism and put it into a Buddhist frame. So that today there's a movement that's been going for 65 years that I believe is a lineage of that ancient blueprint, of that pattern of how to connect the transcendent to the imminent, to the real world of building community, like in the real world community, not separate, like an eco village or an intentional community, which are fine and wonderful. I'm talking about transforming the, you know, the us regular folks, you know, that live in communities, anchoring it like that. So, wow, that was a long answer.
Yeah, there's a lot of places in there I'd like to jump off from, but I'm curious because it's so important in your own life narrative. How did you come across Dr. Aryaratne's work, and what was it that impressed you about him as a human being?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it was timing. So it's in chapter 4 in my book that I titled Jesus Sends Me a Buddhist. And the idea of these titles is I'm purposely trying to disorient people from an established habitual thought process. And I'm doing it lovingly as much as I can. And in the early 90s, I was reading, there was a national newsletter called New Options. It was more political at the time for a kind of a reimagined America at the time. And I found there was a letter to the editor in there, and it mentioned the Sarvodaya movement. So I got really excited about it. And I started doing research. And what really got my attention was, and I didn't know it at the time, but I was looking for a way to seamlessly integrate a private individual spiritual life with community in a collective context. So in other words, if you can imagine, I mean, like the 90s were like coming out of the human potential movement, you know, all these kind of like the new age movement was really building. And I didn't know any of this at the time, but looking back, you know, that's not very filling to kind of cobble together a spirituality by taking all these different so-called ecology of practices and cobbling them together to hope that then somehow there'll be a, you know, we'll develop a multidimensional life that way. And I didn't know it at the time, but I wanted more. I wanted something that's more reality-based. I guess I was sensing at the time in that New Age movement that it was kind of part of that pattern of the culture of separation, that it was itself a phenomenon of postmodernity where you get to construct your own spirituality. And yeah, there's a lot of beauty and positivity to that, but there's some still, there's a vacuum that leads to your mind thinking that you could create your own, you know, spirituality. And I know it's happening within, you know, religious. That's why in Protestantism, there's 30,000 different churches, for God's sakes. So that phenomenon of, you know, fragmentation of spirituality, I was looking for something that was more grounded. And that's what, yeah, got my attention. Sarvodaya really integrates the process of they call Buddhist awakening around what they call the four sublime abodes of Buddhism: compassion, joy in the joy of others, equanimity, and loving kindness. Those are the transcendent energies, or the virtues, or the in Buddha we call those are the sublime abodes. And then they take that individual awakening process and they contextualize it as part of family awakening and village awakening. It's seamless. There's just nothing like that in the West, nothing whatsoever. And I looked and my relationship to that movement was more like, wow, I really want to learn everything I can about that because I believe that that has a key. And they've been doing it. At the time when I found out about them, they had organized or made an impact in 15,000 of the 30,000 villages or communities in Sri Lanka at the time. So that involved millions of people, had a track record of success, and it connected this personal and the collective spiritual development in a way I've never seen before, even till to this day. The irony of it all is that the ancient blueprint that I'd identified initially for me in my own kind of personal observation of the Sermon on the Mount and the impact that Jesus had on me personally, that message of connecting the transcendent and the imminent created a pattern. That ancient blueprint creates a pattern for how to build community. That's how I've interpreted it on a practical level. And I interpret it in terms of building these meta networks that are, you know, that people enter into these with their free will and voluntary. There's no coercion, no political, social, religious kind of sense of like, yeah, you must do this. No, it's people are entering into that. And so that ancient blueprint and how it emerges in community, I found literally what Jesus was talking about and what I think the early Christian or Jesus following movements in the first 100 years, they were really like that. They lived this way. But ironically, what emerged was this beautiful idea of love God and love others, of Jesus, is actually practiced by a South Asian Buddhist, 2,500-year-old civilization. I mean, it's pretty wild. And I noticed that irony about how the most, quote, Christian, if you will, community is not found necessarily in the West. It's literally found within a Buddhist spiritual community movement. I'm not privileging Buddhism either. I'm actually, what happened through my own experience was I became a Jesus follower, which is a whole nother story. We can get into that if you like. I know that's coming up, but anyway, yeah. So that's what really got me. I hope I answered your question, Layman, about why, how I found out about Sarvodaya and what it meant to me. I hope that was not too circuitous.
Circuitous, yeah. It is very interesting to be able to find certain patterns of insight and virtue practice that we associate with a particular cultural tradition. We find it outside that tradition, and it gives us this impression that these might be part of the basic psycho-organic complexity of being human beings. Like it's something deep that we inherit that we can generate or regenerate in different kinds of cultural languages at different times. And so there's this sense that there is an inbuilt, in some ways, bodily sourced type of spirituality and wisdom production that's possible for us. But we're going through this thing that our ancestors went through in all these different ways under very unusual conditions now. We inherit a lot of strange cultural baggage. We're in a position of global systems breakdown and interrelated crises, and we've got a bunch of new technological tools our ancestors did not encounter. So in this situation, this meta-crisis situation, or whatever we want to call it, I saw in your writing this idea that I think permeates a lot of your work, that the global crisis can't be solved globally, it must be solved locally, which I like. But I'm also curious what you think would be some global changes that would really help or complement or accelerate the right kinds of local efforts.
This is a paradox, that's for sure. So when I make that statement or claim, if you will, that we can't solve global problems globally, we have to solve them locally, it implies that I'm kind of given up on integrated, coordinated global action, for example, dealing with climate change and the like. It's not exactly that. So the idea of beginning locally it's not based on the idea of just even exponential growth of communities, because I identified there's like maybe 10 to 50,000 communities from villages, towns, and cities on the planet. So the question is, how do we get the level of consciousness that's informing current global problem solving in a way that's just sick? I mean, it's sick. It's all about power. It's all about money. It's all about control. And it's dominated by an oligarchy, an integration of corporate and political, national, political, and international elites that have emerged. And whether it's conscious or unconscious, they have a plan. They have a plan to, I'm Jewish, so they have a plan to solve the human problem. We're the human problem. We're prone to conflict and violence and unhappiness and depression and all these negative things. So to save the day are these kind of global elites who have a consciousness and an entitlement to their sense of importance and power, that they're there to help us to solve it. So that's the context for all these global movements that are social movements that are trying to change those systems. For example, look at the approach of building a global sustainability movement within the care of Earth. It ended up becoming commodified and adopted by corporations that were just, you know, quote, greenwashing. They totally destroyed the meaning of sustainability. And it's not that they didn't destroy it. It's the system logic. This economic and political system we have is an empire. It's a machine. It just is going to take this input, like sustainability movement, right? That's a strategy. That's a global movement. And it's going to compromise it. And I've seen this ever since I got involved in the anti-nuclear movement in the early 1980s. So I've been around and watching this. I've been participating in these different movements and observing them. So when I say we need local change, I'm saying we need to focus on creating these spheres of coherence of a new cultural construct that people can practice and live in communities so that it can spread rapidly and I would say fractally. It's a fractal empowerment method. There's no delay in it. It's not like a several thousand year process, although probably maybe in its culmination, it'll take thousands of years or hundreds of years. But the transition process to go from where we are to the foundation of a new global civilization, I believe really only can happen on a street, in a neighborhood, in a local community, in local organizations. Because these are the backbone of the global economy. They're not these huge mega corporations or governments. They're the hundreds of millions of organizations, the charities, the Main Street small businesses, even local government. So I'd say getting back to human scale is key, but it's not in opposition to global change. It's just that we have to reorient the pyramid of financial and political power. That is, we need to have a strategy to invert that. Like literally invert it. And in order to do that, we need constructs. And thank God it's not my own idea. Like I said, I'm not promoting something that's like some newfangled thing like, oh yeah, I've got the answer. No, I'm pointing to history. And in history is showing that there's a strategy that relates to the situation we're in regards to empire. And it's very, very specific. Now, Mahatma Gandhi called it a Commonwealth of Village Republics. And his strategy was based on one empire at the time, the British Empire, extracting resources from India and all the, you know, hundreds of thousands of towns, villages that used to be self-sufficient politically and economically. And after more than 100 years of dominance by the British Empire and specifically the East Indian Trading Company, the first multinational at the time, they went from being self-sufficient villages to dependent on this external extractor. So what do you do in a situation like that? So Mahatma Gandhi asked the question, hey, how can 50,000 British dominate 300 million Indians without their cooperation? It got them to see how they're part of that system. So his solution, if you will, was to build a horizontal commonwealth of village republics. Now, of course, he didn't live long enough. He was killed by a Hindu fanatic who thought he was going to compromise too much to the Muslims at the time. But what happened was his idea of what he called Sarvodaya was based on a concept that's a universal solution, if you will, to the problems of empire. Even President Thomas Jefferson, who was the so-called anti-federalist, he lost the debate, but he wanted to organize America as what he called a commonwealth of ward republics. And the ward would be the New England township model of around 5 to 10,000 people. So he wanted a decentralized commonwealth. And Thomas Jefferson lost the debate to the Federalist, James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, who believed that they needed to create a strong federal government to get the colonies in line and united. And I'm not going to argue, you know, whether that was wrong or right. It happened. But Thomas Jefferson had the identical same ideas as Mahatma Gandhi. And Thomas Jefferson's idea was 200 years ago. So I start to see this pattern. I go, wow, that's amazing. This idea of a commonwealth of village republics. Then what I saw was Dr. Ari in Sri Lanka. He implemented it. He built it. He's got a network of 5,000 communities where in each of them, they've built ecosystem networks of existing and new infrastructure organizations to take care of basic human needs from a spiritual foundation. So I saw a pattern that, wow, yeah, it took them decades to build that. But knowing what I know now and having this history of experience of what works as a strategy, I could see how we could rapidly advance the cause of global movements if we just spent a chunk of our energy building these local community ecosystem networks, these symbiotic networks and symbiotic culture, these movements to weave the existing energy, the aggregation of all the capital that's there, the spiritual, the financial, the ecological, the natural, the social, the cultural, the political capitals. By aggregating them and connecting all the good that's already happening, and to get people to see that the threat isn't what's being defined within the culture war. The threat is this imbalance between the global economic, financial, and the political system and every community on this planet. The relationship between the global economy and every community on the planet is extractive, and it's patronizing, it's paternalistic, and it just seeks one thing: to aggregate and continue to build its own machine-like power with no regard for humanity or any interior spiritual values. So people are starting to wake up to this phenomenon. Now, I'm not demonizing the economic system. I'm not going to even say that it's the problem of capitalism. It's actually a problem of some an older pattern of materialism as a worldview, which originated, I guess, 2,500 years ago. It's the Greeks developed an idea that became in Western society materialism. That's the challenge that we face. That materialistic worldview and philosophy has been adopted now for thousands of years. It's been emerging into its culmination today. And that system is in opposition to whole communities. So that's why I privilege the sweet spot of organizing from a strategy point of view, a community. So it's kind of like the three bears, you know, finding the bed that's just right. What's the sweet spot? The sweet spot is not an eco village or an intentional community. And it's not a whole bioregion, which is just too large. The sweet spot where it's just right is where you can aggregate the energy of real people and real enterprises in a real local economy and local ecology and place. And that's the level of a town or a city. And I call that a microbioregional anchor. It's an anchor for a larger bioregion. So that's the sweet spot that I've learned that Sarvodia in Sri Lanka, they've implemented that. And I believe it can be a fractal spread. So of course it's cosmolocal in a sense that the idea is to build up a bottom-up new global financial trading system that's spiritually founded. We have an entire global media system, and it's just being influenced by these values from this top-down empire system. We don't have to overthrow it. We could undergrow it. Yeah, I could see it. I could see it. I could see, like, literally the connection between one person and what one person can do to serve this kind of weaving process. And it doesn't require PhDs, expertise. You don't have to be enlightened. You don't have to be, part of some enlightened class. You don't have to be a theologian, a philosopher, a network expert. It's so much more basic than that. And I believe I've been looking for something like that, that people can relate to more in the mainstream. Wow, that was another long answer, man. Layman.
It's beautiful and it's exciting. And I think it is relatable because this image of an alternative to the oligarchic materialist machinery, it has been on the tip of many people's tongues, and it also retrieves, I think, an ancient tribal sensibility that's deep in the human experience. So we've got this idea here that the alternative is the weaving together of spiritually aligned cosmo-local micro-bioregional anchors.
I like that.
What does the Symbiotic Culture Lab provide to help that move forward?
Wow, what a question. So as I've been, completing my book in the last year, and as I've been engaging a number of leaders of global networks that have community hubs, so I've been looking specifically for global networks that also have that want to have a physical presence in local communities. And in my conversations with them, I've really focused, because this is the entrepreneur part of me. I'm a businessman in the medical field. So I operate a consulting business helping freestanding hyperbaric centers that do hyperbaric oxygen therapy. So I'm passionate about it, but to some extent, it's not my true passion. And yet I that business still happens, still going today. But from that, for whatever reason, I've always brought an entrepreneurial sensibility even to this realm. So I've been listening to the leaders of these global movements, the networks that have local community presence hubs. And I'm sensing into what their real need is, rather than what I theorize it is. So what I've done is I've delayed completing the section 3 of my book. Like, I've only written like 80% of it on purpose. I went on the edge. I released the beginning part of the book, and my wife is saying, "Why would you do that?" And I said, "Well, because I'm learning from the people. I'm going to co-create with the reader to let me know how to drill down even further the idea of symbiotic culture." So one thing that I learned a year ago, as I was engaging these leaders, and I had a general idea of a symbiotic culture lab as a kind of a global organization, I realized without knowing it, unwittingly, I was triggering the immune response of peoples to territoriality, thinking that I was a competitive organization. And you can never overcome that. There's nothing you can do about it. It is ingrained in humanity. It's the tribal sensibility. It has to do with threat and flight or fight, you know what I mean? To assess deep, deep sense of survival, like going back, you know, 100,000 years. So when I realized that, when I had this one construct for delivering this and helping communities to activate, I thought, even myself traditionally, oh, okay, I'll build a global network like that. I realized, wow, how easy it is to fall prey to a quote colonizing extractive mindset. I was like going through, I was like, I got it. I go, oh my gosh, if I develop like a global organization, Symbiotic Culture Lab as a formal organization, I'm missing the point. So then I shifted and I realized, oh my gosh, instead of me building a separate thing, I need to support these existing global networks who want to do something in local communities. I need to support them. So then I shifted completely from promoting symbiotic culture to finding out how I could serve them. How can symbiotic culture in the network process, the weaving, the context? It's not an organization. So I'm not building a separate anything like that. It's like a unifying worldview that provides a new context to actively empower and engage communities that they empower themselves. They own these networks. It's inconsistent to have a separate outside external global organization, even one that's well-intentioned, to come in and to tell communities what to do. That's just old. That's the old pattern. So I have to like learn this myself. I go, oh, damn. So then I realized, wow, okay. So the model that I've come across now is I'm not forming a separate organization. Now, Symbiotic Culture Lab was a kind of an idea, a name. I don't even know if I'm going to use that eventually when the book comes out and I start meeting the leaders that are inspired and want to do this kind of work in their own communities. I'm going to learn from them. I'm waiting to learn from them rather than me jumping ahead thinking I know with some like linear construct. But that's what it looks like. It's basically a global network with a community hub. They already have people in communities. These global networks with community hubs are actually threads. So there's multiple threads of counterculture that exist. And I've backed up into a more cosmic view that's not pushing any political or religious agenda. I want to see who these threads are. So the idea is that the symbiotic culture, its process is ultimately to help communities form a nucleus, and I call it a symbiotic society. It's not like a separate organization, like a business or a charity. It's not a money-making thing. I know a lot of people told me, oh yeah, you got to make it so that people can make money. You know what I mean? Like to do the work. Nope, I'm not going to do that. It's got to be pristine. It's got to be pure. The people worldwide don't trust anymore. They don't trust systems. They don't trust business. They don't trust generally religion. They don't trust science, academia. In a situation like that, I'm not going to introduce a model that's based on some financial incentive. There's no need. It's much simpler than that. So ultimately, that's where I came to the conclusion is I want to work with existing networks, you know, like the liminal, you know, Limicon. You know, there's a lot of cool people there. So it would basically, in a sense, be presenting this idea. Whoever's interested, if they're already working in community, they can add it to their repertoire of tools and begin down this road of weaving their community together. I think it's as simple and as straightforward as that.
In all the things you express, I hear a deep concern for the question of trust, for the erosion of trust, for the possibility of taking a role that might trigger the mistrust of others, for the possibility of a deep existential trust in the nature of the world and its processes. Yeah. I'm curious. On the one hand, rebuilding trust is an enormous challenge. None of these projects were thinking about work without trust. And part of that trust is, being shown things that aren't dangerous or aren't trying to intrude, that aren't triggering those territorial responses, learning that you can work with things that are trustworthy. But part of that is an internal thing where we have to regain the capacity to be trusting beings. And what do you see as some, practical approaches for an individual to regain the ability to be a trusting person?
Wow, that's an amazing question, Layman. I'm very, I hope I'm clear in the book in that I'm not presenting new spiritual practices. I didn't want to go down a path where I was seen as somehow presenting a new religion or a new philosophy or a new spiritual teaching. Because that generally that's the answer you would get. Oh, try my recipe. Here's my recipe. This is what you need to do. So it's a real fine line. So symbiotic culture, one way of looking at it, it's like a vitamin supplement, maybe. It's like a supplemental spiritual practice. So in other words, I'm honoring the fact that my reader and the others who could be interested in this are already embedded in religious formal organizations or spiritual organizations. So I need to first honor that. So from my perspective, trust happens when they know I'm not trying to impose my own, ego-based view. Oh, try this spirituality. No, that's not what it is. So that's the first thing. Would be is honoring people's existing relationship with the transcendent as they define it. I'd say the first step, and I do go into this in the book, it's really important, which is that it's important to have universal constructs in the realm of worldview and ideas that cross all these different divisions. So one way to build trust and trustworthiness is to focus on shared ideas around spirituality. So one of the shared ideas, whether it's Eastern, Western spirituality, indigenous, is the notion of virtues and the embodiment of virtues. So I believe that's the commonality. So there, it's not about teaching people about virtue. I don't know if you probably remember Socrates in a dialogue. Someone asked him, "Master, tell me how I could learn virtue." And Socrates apparently was saying something to the effect, "Hey, dude, you can't learn it. You have to activate it because it comes from the divine. It's a principle that's inherent. It's an embodiment. I call it a transcendent energy." Without getting into metaphysics or cosmology, which I have no background in it, but I have to communicate the best I can. In the connection between the transcendent pattern or the ancient blueprint and us and embodiment, the way that we experience that transcendent is not just through these experiences of something vast and interconnected, but we experience it embodied within us in all creation. Let's just call those transcendent energies. It's like the residue of this pattern that's implicit and implicate in everything. It's like this pattern that's just ancient pattern. It's within everything. Virtues are like that. So virtues are like a non-material energy that's embodied within the human personality. And it has a role, it has an actual function. Its function is to organize and unify our personality. So, for example, some people could think that they're being compassionate, but they've got no wisdom or love. Some people, they can do all sorts of things without a constellation of these virtues. So these virtues all go together. They're transcendent energies. So the first step, I believe, of becoming trustworthy and energetically stepping into this role of holding space for a community is acknowledging that however a person defines this transcendent, that the embodiment of these virtues are primary and are foundational and important. So in that sense, it's not a new idea, right? Challenge is that we talk about virtue all the time, but we live in a global machine-like civilization that is promoting the anti-virtues. For example, generosity is universally considered a virtue by every religious and spiritual system and secular civic culture. And yet we live in a system that promotes the exact antithesis to generosity, avarice. It's just so obvious how this is working. Like it's like becoming apparent to me how this system maintains itself. So the most radical act is to cultivate what is our divinely or embodied nature, which is our capacity to live this way and to choose this way, to focus on these what could be considered positive virtues and to focus on addressing and dealing with the negative virtues as they emerge within us. So I think a virtue-based practice is probably where the rubber meets the road. And a person can get there through prayer, meditation, snowboarding, bird watching, swimming, having a child, becoming a parent, being in a relationship. So it's like those are the opportunities. So I don't have anything like really specific in terms of a practice other than to focus on what's common and shared. And that's like a step one. And the what I'm going to share in the book is helping people to actually develop a symbiotic society. So it's like a local group, and I'm modeling it after Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm modeling it on this kind of informal, horizontal, lay-led network process. The only difference is AA, they want to keep to themselves. Like part of their guidelines is they don't share what's happening in there. But a symbiotic society is the exact opposite. You share and you support each other in practicing these virtues so we can transform culture. That's the purpose of the symbiotic society, is to create a support system so that we can work through how we've been affected by this culture so we can turn it into positive action and support one another to make this transition. It's, I don't know, I hate to use the Matrix analogy, but it's kind of like a weird thing because there's nowhere to go. You know what I mean? There's not like a separate reality to escape from. So it's kind of like, to some extent, you've got to reconnect with the transcendent, but then bring that energy back into you to almost re-inhabit your consciousness so that you're not as attached to all these identities that we have in the world. You're not getting rid of those identities. That's stupid, impossible. That's the way the world is. We're male, female, we're business people, we're religious, not religious, we're agnostic, we're politicians, whatever, the myriad of connections and separation that we have. However, yeah, we need to re-embody that transcendent and make that the primary driving identity. So it's kind of like, hi, my name is Richard. I'm here from the transcendent. It's kind of like that. And then you're embodying it. And then as you re-inhabit yourself, it's kind of like a true Occupy movement. It's like reoccupying your own individual personality and realizing through the light of this spiritual reality, it's showing you yourself. It's showing you all of our patterns. It's making them, it's like a light on all the shadow. It just emerges and you can see it. And the virtues help with that. It helps you navigate this process of unifying your personality so that you're able to once and for all follow and be capable of connecting to deep intuition, which comes from the transcendent. To me, that's my way of looking at it and phrasing it. So, wow, man, you really get me going, Layman. I'm so happy that you're giving me this opportunity to share. I can't tell you how much I appreciate you and what you're doing, man. I really do.
Thank you. You're clearly a guy who likes to and is capable of learning. You've gone into a lot of rich knowledge areas, and I can hear in the way you express yourself that you're picking up ideas from various leading edge thinkers in your attempt to figure out how to articulate the things that you've seen and lived out. I'm curious where you're getting the most value lately in terms of reading or who you're listening to, or what sources lately have you really been drawing on that you feel are really useful and aligned to your work?
I'm going to say something that's probably, I don't know how your listeners react to it, but the Bible. We haven't really shared my own kind of spiritual leanings, but just to summarize, and what I'm describing in my book is what was when I was a child at 12 to 15, and then even to the early 20s and my mid 20s. I saw the transcendent as an abstract it. And I could see that perspective. And many people were telling me, oh, yeah, that's the ultimate. It's beyond, that personal relationship, like with a figure like Jesus or Krishna or other, religious figures. Oh, that's the past. Well, what happened to me was over, like, I don't know, 15 years, and I get into this because it's really important to me. There was a segment of my life in my mid-20s where I was living with an Aztec medicine woman in Mexico who was a Christian, and I apprenticed with her. And she was like the real deal. Like somebody, if you were to define enlightenment or awakened human being, it would be the capacity to transcend your sense of individual self in service to others, where it becomes natural. So it's a natural thing. It's just real. It's like Mother Teresa or a vision of folks that we might see. So she was had an impact on me, and it reinforced something that then led to an experience I had in 1990. And it's yeah, it was the personalization of the transcendent from an impersonal it to a personal relationship with Jesus. Now, what's interesting about it is I didn't immediately then say, well, I must be a Christian. And yet, in part of the community movements, I've befriended religious leaders as part of interfaith movements in communities. But yeah, so then I did find at the way that I was progressing when I read the Bible, I was reading it probably, if it's possible, to read it from a non-dual perspective. And just things that just are so meaningful to me. Like, for example, when Jesus said something like, I didn't come to bring peace, I came to bring a sword. I mean, oh my gosh, it's so beautiful. As I get more deeply into trying to understand what that could even mean, like dividing your family, dividing your husband and wife, or parents from kids, or what? I mean, it's like really shocking until I got into things like that more, or things like be in the world but not of it. What does that mean? What does it mean to love God with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself? Like I guess I took those things to heart, and I got down a path. So yeah, that's interesting. But yeah, probably the Bible. And I find it filled with rich wisdom. That's me. That's my own personal path. To be part of symbiotic culture, you don't have to agree with my perspective on it. It's more about transcendent embodiment of those energies in the form of virtues and living it. So it's more important, the lived experience. And that's the action, not the belief. But anyway, hey, thanks for letting me share that or go more
Yeah,
into
that's
detail.
great. And I have the sense that you and I need to have more than one conversation in order to get a lot of this stuff explored. But we're probably at the end of what we can reasonably expect a viewer or listener to go through at 90 minutes. So let's bring this to an end, and I'll say that I've really enjoyed your curiosity and your enthusiasm and the amount of heart and energy that you are bringing to projects that I think are a part of an essential wave for making a better world that we live in. So I've really enjoyed this, Richard. Thank you.
Me too. I've really enjoyed spending time with you, and I'm so happy that we got to meet, even virtually. So I'm excited to continue to explore another any way that you feel would be supportive of your work. And that's the last thing I was reading about your meta modern the business, the network idea, and things like that. I'm happy to offer any support to your own work and networks freely. So,
Okay. Very appreciated. Thank you.
anyway.